Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, February 21st. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midland County. County approves Certificate of Obligation for Jail. Will use it to finance new $170 million facility over 20 years. By Ben Schaffer, staff writer. Midland County will use the planned Certificate of Obligation to finance a new jail over 20 years. The new jail is set to be an 800-bed, 230,000-square-foot facility at County Road 1140 and County Road 110. It will cost around $170 million, according to the county. The county decided on a repayment plan that was originally intended to pay off the project in 20 years. The annual debt service, according to a presentation by George Williford of Hilltop Securities in early February, would be $13,347,619, assuming a collection percentage of 98%. In December, county commissioners voted to pay for the jail using a certificate of obligation, non-voter-approved debt, rather than holding a vote in the form of a bond. Commissioners agreed that a new jail was a county necessity, and since this has been a discussion for 3 to 5 years, county commissioners wanted to start the planning and building process. Coming into Tuesday, the county needed 4 of 5 county commissioners to approve the funding plan to move forward with the Certificate of Obligation. Precinct 4 Commissioner Diane Anderson was not in attendance Tuesday, so it needed 3 of 4 votes. The jail is proposed to be in Commissioner Jeff Sommer's Precinct 2. Since the beginning of the process, Sommer has taken issue with the jail being near homes and schools in his precinct, though he does agree a new jail in the county is a need. Just 2 Midlanders voiced concerns about the project during public comment. They live near the proposed site and only took issue with the location of the jail, not the funding plan. A Greenwood resident voiced her concerns about the location. The safety of our children is obviously of utmost concern, and our citizens. Not sure if you are aware that we just passed a bond in Greenwood, and we will be building a new elementary school just a few miles up the road from this proposed location, she said. This will put the community at risk, she said. She said the community is used to having the jail in its current location, and the county could look at ways to expand the current location. When they, inmates, are released, where are they going to be going? They are going to be wandering the community, going into our backyards and neighborhoods. The other concerned citizen echoed a similar statement. Sommers agreed with the pair. County Judge Terry Johnson said they have spent 3 years coming up with a location for the jail, and the current location of the jail is around residential homes as well. Precinct 1 Commissioner Scott Ramsey echoed that the current jail is near homes. I believe this plan is best for what we're trying to accomplish, Johnson said. On another note, this will get us into the 2050s as far as a jail. Johnson said he did not want to have to wait any longer to start the project, given it has been an idea for a long time. Ramsey said he likes the location of the current jail, but if they were to build again at that location, the facility could be no bigger than 750 beds, and it wouldn't be expandable in the future. The current plan for the jail is an 800-bed facility. No matter what we do, we're going to put it in somebody's backyard. Right now it's in somebody's backyard where it's at. Nobody wants it, he said. Ramsey added that he visited a facility in Tom Green County, designed by the same architect hired for this project. He said it was a nice, inconspicuous building, and no locals have reported any safety concerns after talking with law enforcement in Tom Green County. Precinct 3 Commissioner Luis Sanchez said they have searched for property for the jail for 5 years, and this is the most optimal. County Judge Terry Johnson asked Sheriff David Kreiner about ways to make inmate or prisoner release safer for the community, like limiting situations where recent releases from the jail just walk out onto the street without a mode of transportation. No amendments of that variety were voted on, and the sheriff's office and county want to do what they can to limit any safety concerns the Greenwood residents brought forward. Kreiner said he would meet with the jail commission about these topics. "Whatever it takes to keep the community safe, I'm all for," Kreiner said. "If there's concerns about where the jail is, we need to take care of our citizens, because they are law-abiding citizens. We don't need to cater to the bad guys." Summers acknowledged that the new facility is a need at some place at some point in time. The land itself is optimal to build on, and this has been a long process, but he remained consistent with his viewpoint on the location during Tuesday's vote. He said he would support any community safety amendments or initiatives that the sheriff's office puts forward. As for repayment, Williford shared there is typically a 10-year prepayment period where the county can prepay the project with no penalty. But if there's money available before that, it's what you have done on the refunding issue. You can put that money into escrow, he said. Williford said the county can use money from escrow accounts to possibly shorten the initial 20-year prepayment period. The jail project passed, with Summers dissenting. Williford shared in early February that the next step in the process is for underwriters to create pricing and marketing for the Certificate of Obligation, either on February 26th to 29th or March 4th to 7th. This article is entitled, "One Dead Following Vehicle Collision in Martin County," by B.K. Richter. A 24-year-old man from Levine, Arizona, was pronounced dead following a vehicle collision Monday morning in Martin County. The Texas Department of Public Safety reported Martin Ricky Gomez was traveling northbound in a 2015 Ford Fiesta on FM 3033 at 5:21 a.m. 45-year-old Miguel Angel Dominguez of Snyder was traveling westbound on State Highway 176 in a 2023 GMC 2500. According to the crash report, the driver of the Fiesta reportedly ignored the stop sign at the intersection of State Highway 176 and was struck by the GMC 2500. Gomez was pronounced dead at the scene of the collision. This incident remains under investigation, and no further information is available. This article is entitled, "Local Apartment Blaze Displaces 22 Residents." Firefighters responded to a structure fire on Monday. By B.K. Richter, staff writer. The Midland Fire Department responded to a structure fire at the 1200 block of East Wadley Avenue during the early morning hours Monday. Both the Midland Fire Department and the Midland Police Department worked to evacuate residents from the apartment complex as firefighters worked more than 3 hours to extinguish the blaze. A total of 6 fire engines responded to the fire. 8 apartment units were impacted in the fire, and 22 residents were displaced as a result of the blaze, which the fire department said started with an individual cooking. According to reports, one person was injured during the blaze. Midland Fire Department officials stated that the investigation remains ongoing. The American Red Cross for the Permian Basin assisted in finding housing for displaced residents who were impacted by the fire. Shane Bell has been the Red Cross Disaster Action Team coordinator for more than 30 years. Bell reported to the scene of the fire and said that the Red Cross helped 7 families with immediate assistance. "What we do when we get on the scene is offer direct assistance to the families," he said during a phone interview Tuesday. "The families can go shopping to try and replace some of their items that were lost, or even a hotel," Bell said. Bell also said that while Midland does not have the issue that it had during the 1990s with apartment fires, there are still a few fires every year. "Smoke alarms save lives," he said. "On average, we have 1 to 2 apartment fires every year." Bell also shared that his organization is seeking volunteers for the Red Cross Disaster Recovery Team. For more information, go to www.redcross.org/become-a-volunteer.html #STEP1. This article is entitled "Man Arrested for Sexual Abuse of Child" by B.K. Richter, staff writer. The Midland County Sheriff's Office reported the arrest of a man accused of the sexual abuse of a child. According to reports, the Midland County Sheriff's Office Criminal Investigation Division obtained an arrest warrant for Christopher John Olmos for alleged continuous sexual abuse of a child, a first-degree felony. The Midland County Sheriff's Office Warrants Division, along with assistance from the U.S. Marshals Service, located and arrested Olmos on February 15th. Olmos was arrested in the 8400 block of East County Road 114 in Midland County. Olmos was later transported and booked into the Midland County Central Detention Center. No other information has been released. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled "Rig Count Falls Across U.S. Decline in Drilling Activity in the Country, Texas, and Permian Basin" by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Drilling activity continues its gradual downward trend, falling for the second time in the last 3 weeks. Oilfield services firm Baker Hughes said Friday the U.S. rig count it has issued weekly for the last 70 years fell 2 rigs to 621 for the week. That's 139 rigs, or 18% below the 760 rigs the company reported last year. The number of rigs drilling for crude fell 2 rigs to 497, 110 less than the 607 rigs at work seeking crude last year. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas held steady at 121 rigs, 30 less than the 151 counted last February. Texas fell below 300 rigs, dropping 2 rigs to 299 for the week, 71 less than the 371 rigs active across the state the previous year. New Mexico was unchanged at 101 rigs. Kansas, 1, joined Texas in seeing a decline, while Oklahoma was the only major producing state to see an increase. The Permian Basin dropped 1 rig for 312 rigs, down 40 rigs from the 352 rigs at work across the region last year. Eddy County, New Mexico, remains the most active county in the Permian Basin with 54 rigs, unchanged for the week. Lee County, New Mexico, is second with 44 rigs, also unchanged for the week. Martin County reported 37 rigs, unchanged for the week. Reeves County followed with 28 rigs, also unchanged for the week. Loving County reported 23 rigs, down 1. Midland and Upton counties each reported 19 rigs, down 3 from Midland, the steepest drop among Permian counties, and up 2 for Upton, the sharpest increase among Permian Basin counties. Reagan County had 14 rigs, up 1, and Ward County had 13 rigs, down 1 for the week. Howard County added a rig for 12 rigs. Energy-focused software-as-a-service firm Enverus said its U.S. rig count for the week ended February 9th fell 7 rigs to 666 from 673 the previous week and is 184 rigs, or 22%, below the 850 rigs reported last year. ConocoPhillips, EOG Resources, and Occidental Petroleum led the list of top 10 U.S. operators by rig count, with 30 rigs each. Up 1 for ConocoPhillips, down 1 for EOG, and unchanged for Occidental. Enverus's Permian rig count rose 1 to 327 from 326 the previous week, but is 39 rigs, or 11%, below the 366 rigs reported last year. The Delaware Basin remains by far the most active play with 176 rigs, unchanged from the previous week, but 19 rigs, or 10%, below the 195 rigs seen last year. The Midland Basin is second with 124 rigs, down 1 for the week, and 25 rigs, or 17%, from the 149 rigs counted last year. The training 30-day permits for the Permian Basin was 693 for the week ended January 26th, up from 622 the previous week and down from 745 a year earlier. The Permian also saw a decline in frac crews to 96 as of the week ended January 26th, from 109 the previous week and from 134 a year earlier. This article is entitled, SWAT Helps in Arrest Evidence Collection, by the City of Midland, submitted to MRT. On Monday, around 8:30 p.m., Midland SWAT was called out to the 4400 block of Lanham Street in reference to an assault. Midland police reported that the subject, identified as 56-year-old James Morton, was arrested without incident on a charge of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Police also collected the firearm on Monday evening. This article is entitled, Texas Gives $125 Million to Rural Sheriffs, Prosecutors for Raises, by Carlos Nogueros Ramos, the Texas Tribune. Odessa. Texas has awarded $125 million in grants to rural sheriffs and prosecutors across the state, the Texas comptroller said in a statement last week. An effort to help those law enforcement agencies attract and keep talent in their communities. The pool of money was established by state lawmakers last year in Senate Bill 22, which passed with bipartisan support. The legislation, authored by State Senator Drew Springer, Republican Munster, totaled $330 million and established grants for increasing minimum salaries and additional equipment. Rural law enforcement can apply for the grant again in 2025, which the comptroller will issue using the remaining money. The comptroller's office, which, among other duties, manages the state's budget and collects taxes, began accepting applications last year and determined the amount each county would receive by population size. Only counties with a population smaller than 300,000 were eligible for the grant. Of Texas's 254 counties, 236 have populations slimmer than 300,000, according to a 2022 estimate from the Texas Demographic Center. The comptroller's office said 94% of eligible sheriff's offices applied for money. Nearly 86% of eligible prosecutors' offices applied, the comptroller said. The controller awarded grants to 224 sheriff offices and 138 prosecutor's offices. The grants recipients must first raise pay, with sheriffs earning $75,000, deputies $45,000, and jailers $40,000, before using the money to buy equipment. The grants ranged from $250,000 to $500,000 for sheriff's offices. Prosecutors could apply for anywhere between $100,000 and $275,000. The money is a start to reverse a long-term decline of prosecutors in rural Texas communities, said Pamela Metzger, executive director of the Decent Criminal Justice Reform Center at the SMU Dedman School of Law. I think it's terrific that the legislature is recognizing our rural criminal justice communities, Metzger said. Texas has experienced a sharp, years-long decline in criminal defense attorneys, a report authored by Metzger at the legal think tank found. The study gathered the number of practicing lawyers in the state whose addresses and offices were in the state using the Bar Association's database. Less than 1% of lawyers practice criminal defense law in rural parts of Texas, hampering the ability of rural prosecutors' offices to find and employ public defenders it could dispatch to courts. Metzger said that an individual accused of a crime in a major city typically has a guaranteed public defender representing them in court within a day. If you live anywhere else, you'll have to wait 72 hours, or maybe a weekend, just because of where you live, Metzger said. And the influx of money is a boon for law enforcement offices with lean budgets operating in counties with a smaller tax base, said Michael Lascano, a chief deputy at Reeves County and vice president of the Big Bend Area Law Enforcement Officers Association, an organization representing 20 law enforcement agencies in West Texas, the majority of which are rural. These funds might not be there next year, so it's good for smaller agencies to have, Lascano said. Still, Lascano said money is one part of the equation. He said that law enforcement agencies, especially rural ones, will continue to grapple with recruitment. For new recruits, it's different, Lascano said. It's not very appealing anymore to the younger generation to come into law enforcement. A 2022 study by the U.S. Department of Justice found that recruiting has been a persisting challenge for sheriff's offices. The number of full-time sworn officers, 174,000, has not increased since 1997. Sheriff's offices have closed personnel gaps by employing more civilians, whose participation more than doubled in the last two decades. The number of civilians occupying administrative roles rose to 191,000 in 2020, according to the report. This article originally appeared in the Texas Tribune. The Texas Tribune is a member-supported, nonpartisan newsroom informing and engaging Texans on state politics and policy. Learn more at texastribune.org. This is the Life Tributes column. Cecil Joe Sane, December 20th, 1936 to February 14th, 2024. Cecil Joe Sane, 87, of Midland, formerly San Angelo, passed away on Wednesday, February 14th, after a long battle with dementia. Visitation will be February 21st at the branch at Nally Pickle and Welch in Midland at 10:30 a.m. Service will follow at 12 noon in the Nally Pickle and Welch Chapel. Graveside services will be at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Cecil was born on December 20, 1936, in Olustee, Oklahoma, to Bert Gardner Sane and Mina Juanita Maxie Sane. Cecil grew up in Amarillo, Texas, and in El Dorado, Oklahoma, where he lived with his grandparents. In 1955, at 18 years old, Cecil married the love of his life, Dorothy Jean Rhodes, in Lawton, Oklahoma. Upon his discharge from the Air Force, Cecil and Dorothy moved to Midland. Cecil is survived by his loving wife of 69 years, Dorothy Sane, his son Rick Sane, Knickerbocker, Texas, his daughter Nancy Sane Mabry, her husband Tim, Midland, grandson Josh Mabry, Midland, granddaughter Carrie Ann Sane, Midland, as well as two great-grandchildren, his sister Yolanda Gail Grant, Amarillo, brother John Cockrell, San Angelo, and special friend Evangelina Torres. Cecil was preceded in death by his grandson Jared Mabry. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Angels Care Hospice. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Tony says, losing employer benefits with dental and enrolling in Medicare by guest contributor, February 21st, 2024, by Tony King. Dear Tony, I will be eligible for Medicare in July and am now receiving cancer treatment. I'm currently on my ex-employer's COBRA and searching for dental care when I go on Medicare in July. The only dental vision plans I am finding are in Medicare Advantage plans, but my cancer facility has advised me not to go in that direction because many Medicare Advantage plans are no longer accepted at their facility. Is there a dental plan that Medicare offers? Please advise. Tammy from Alvin, Texas. Hello, Tammy. What's not covered by Part A and Part B is explained on page 55 of the 2024 Medicare and You Handbook under what isn't covered under Part A and Part B. It states, Medicare does not cover everything, and if you need certain services that Medicare Part A and Part B doesn't cover, you will have to pay for them yourself unless you have other coverage, including Medicaid, to cover the costs. You are in a Medicare Advantage plan or Medicare cost plan that covers these services. Medicare Advantage plans and Medicare cost plans may cover some extra benefits like fitness programs and vision, hearing, and dental services. Some of the items and services that original Medicare does not cover include eye examinations for prescription eyeglasses, long-term care, cosmetic surgery, massage therapy, routine physical exams, hearing aids and exams for fitting them, concierge care, also called concierge medicine, retainer-based medicine, boutique medicine, platinum practice, or direct care. Covered items or services you get from an opt-out doctor or doctor not accepting Medicare. Go to page 60, Most Dental Care. Original Medicare doesn't cover dental services like routine cleanings, fillings, tooth extractions, or items like dentures. However, in some cases, Original Medicare may pay for some dental services related to specific medical procedures like a heart valve repair or replacement, an organ transplant, cancer-related treatments. Since Medicare does not cover dental, I would recommend that you talk to your dentist and see which dental insurance plan he or she prefers. Chapter 2 of Tony's Medicare Survival Guide Advanced Edition also discusses what is not covered by Medicare. When purchasing a dental plan, there are two types of dental plans to pick from. Verify which type of plan your dentist accepts before purchasing. Number 1, traditional or indemnity dental insurance plans are generally higher in premium and the preventative services are usually covered at 100%. Basic restorative is generally covered up to 80% and major procedures at 50%. Recently, new dental plans have been released which help with the cost of dental claims such as filing, fillings, crowns, and root canals. A major surprise is that these plans begin immediately with no wait. Number 2, discount dental insurance plans are generally less expensive than traditional dental plans. These plans provide a discount for services, but your dentist must be a part of the plan's network and agree to give the dental discount. You can use either type of dental plan with original Medicare or without a Medicare supplement or with a Medicare Advantage plan. Again, make sure that the plan you choose is accepted by the dentist you like. You did not ask about vision benefits, Tammy, but readers may want to know that the Medicare handbook discusses eyeglasses after cataract surgery. This is a limited benefit because Medicare will cover one pair of eyeglasses with standard frames or one set of contact lenses after cataract surgery that implants an intraocular lens. The Medicare Part B deductible will apply, and after you meet the Part B deductible, you pay 20% of the Medicare-approved amount. Medicare Advantage plans have different cost and copays for vision benefits. Tony's new course, Confused About Medicare, a downloadable video series, and the Medicare Survival Guide Advanced Edition are available at TonySays.com.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, February 17th. Hold on, election is going to be a wild ride. Early voting for the primary begins Tuesday in Ector County, with everything from the chance to vote for a presidential candidate all the way down ballot to Ector County precinct chairs. The national political soap opera of what looks to be another Trump versus Biden presidential race in November is nothing compared to the local drama shaping up in Ector County. There will be a packed ballot on the Republican side for a number of county offices, as well as the contested precinct chair races for the local party. All county offices up for election will be decided in the primary, as there are no Democratic challengers. Here's a look at some races. Ector County GOP Chair. Republican Donna Kelm says she wants to get the Ector County GOP back on track. She said that means an end to current chair Tisa Crowe's time as the head of the party. Kelm said she is against some of the current tactics being used, including endorsing one Republican over another in local races, and the use of fake social media accounts to attack Odessans who question the local GOP. Kelm herself was treated harshly at the Ector County Republican Party headquarters after she refused to block walk for candidates that she did not know. Kelm says she wants to create an environment where candidates feel free to run without being intimidated and will speak out against local party executive board members who lash out and bully candidates they oppose. Kelm worked for more than a month to secure 3 signatures, 10%, from current Ector County precinct chairs so she could get a spot on the ballot to challenge longtime leader Crowe. The signatures were required under Texas legislation originally passed to keep Democrats from grabbing powerful seats by running for local party chair spots. Crowe and her supporters have long said it is the law and challengers must get 10% of the local party chairs to sign to even get on the ballot. However, the statute allows counties under a certain population to opt out of the required 10%. Midland County has done just that, but Crowe and her precinct chairs have not. Many of the current precinct chairs were appointed by Crowe or have never faced an opponent in a primary. That changes this March, as local businessman Ronnie Lewis gathered a number of Odessans to challenge sitting precinct chairs for control of the party. Crowe and her people have sought to paint him as a Democratic operative, but Lewis said he is a Republican and just wants civility back and for the bullying of Odessans by top leadership of the local GOP to stop. He cites how fake Facebook accounts are used to intimidate and bully anyone who doesn't agree with everything local party leaders are doing. Earlier this year, several fake profiles were used to disparage Lewis and his wife. The fake profiles Finnegan Lane, Josiah Vargas, Mitt Harvey, Joshua Benjamin, and others routinely denigrate Lewis and others. Some local party officials don't use a fake account. Current precinct chair for 111, Frieda Daniels, faces Jason Pond in the primary and was blocked from the Odessa American Facebook page for remarks about Lewis's wife being a mail order bride, which violates OA's standards. Daniels was blocked after she called Lewis's wife a mail order bride and was told by the page administrator that racist and inappropriate remarks would not be tolerated and she would be blocked if she did it again. She responded to that by posting, "What if it is true?" and was blocked. Daniels emailed the OA the next day asking to be unblocked and wrote, quote, "You must realize the act of obtaining a wife in such a way happens all over the world, even the USA. Some are even white. It doesn't refer to women of color. So no, I am not a racist, nor was it a racist remark. You don't even know me," end quote. Lewis said the attack is typical of those currently in power. Quote, "I got very angry the first time I saw it. But as Frieda Daniels repeatedly used this Asian racial slur over and over towards my angelic wife, it reminded me of exactly why I'm fighting Tisha Crowe and her appointed precinct chairs," Lewis said. "I was inspired to work harder. These types of demeaning attacks are what keeps Odessa's citizens from running for office or opposing Tisha Crowe." Ironically, Frieda's opponent is half Korean. His father met his mother while stationed in Korea serving our country. Hopefully, karma finds its way to Precinct 111 and elects Jason Pond," end quote. Lewis will face Carmen Wilhite in the primary. She was appointed to her precinct chair in December. Kelm said she sought Wilhite's signature to run for party chair, but did not get it. She said she was shocked by the tone of some of the questions Wilhite asked her prior to refusing to sign for Kelm to run. Quote, "It was a nice conversation at first," Kelm said. "She," that is, Wilhite, "questioned me about how I voted in the November election last year," end quote. Kelm said she told Wilhite she voted for retired teachers to get a raise, and Wilhite said, "Why on earth would you do that?" Kelm said she believed teachers deserved a cost of living increase, and that is what she told Wilhite. But the troubling questions, Kelm said, were when Wilhite demanded to know what Kelm would do if a gay guy walks in off the streets and wants to be part of our Republican Party. Kelm said Wilhite also asked if she would allow a gay guy to work at headquarters. Kelm found the line of questioning shocking. She said Wilhite eventually said she liked what Tisha Crowe was doing and she didn't need to be replaced by Kelm. Kelm has also questioned Crowe's use of campaign materials, telling voters not to fall for trans Republicans. Contacted by phone, Wilhite said she would return a call to the Odessa American, but did not. Ned Luscombe is the precinct chair in 207 and faces Jet Brown in the primary. Kelm said she sought Luscombe's signature to run, but he turned her down, and also told her the current precinct chairs would keep her from taking over if she were to defeat Crow. Quote, "We aren't going to allow that to happen," he told her. Kelm said he also said he didn't like her voting record. She said she has voted Republican since 1976. Endorsements. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths, who doesn't face a challenger for his third term as sheriff, isn't endorsing anyone this election cycle. A recent Facebook post by Odessa Accountability Project stated Griffiths and Odessa Fire and Rescue Chief Jason Cotton were endorsing Odessa City Councilwoman Denise Swanner, who hopes to be Precinct 206 chair. She will be up for re-election to Odessa City Council in November. The Facebook post later cited a misunderstanding about the Griffiths endorsement. Cotton's endorsement was later removed with no explanation before the entire post was deleted. Griffiths has said he told all candidates who asked for an endorsement he was not endorsing anyone weeks before the false post. Fake news sites on social media and fake Facebook profiles have played a part in this year's Republican primary, with 16 mostly newcomers challenging a group of mostly appointed precinct chairs, along with a contested Hector County Party chair seat, two county commissioner seats, and a justice of the peace slot. The two groups essentially line up with those supporting incumbent Crow and those who support Kelm. The fake Facebook accounts have attacked Kelm and her supporters in recent weeks, including Swanner's opponent, longtime Odessan Brenda Worthen, who said the fake Facebook account Josiah Vargas has repeatedly attacked her. Swanner is listed as a friend on the fake account and has posted replies to the Vargas account. Swanner has previously denied knowing the account was fake, but also posted at one point that Vargas had bought her lunch. When questioned about it last year, she said she never pays for her own lunch and doesn't research to see what profiles are real or fake. Prior to the recent Griffiths phony endorsements, Crow, in December, said State Senator Kevin Sparks had endorsed her. Sparks' office, however, said he was not endorsing in this or any other local race. Sparks himself reiterated his non-endorsement policy to the OA. He texted, quote, "Both candidates have been very active in Hector County for many years. The community needs to make their election without undue influence," end quote. Crow is endorsed by Gun Owners of America and supported by Dr. Richard Bartlett. Justice of the Peace. Longtime lawman Carlos Chavez is seeking a full term as Precinct 1 Justice of the Peace after being named to the post in April 2023 following J.P. Terry Lang's retirement. Chavez, a Republican, is facing challenger Jennifer Woodall, who declined an interview with the Odessa American but filled out a candidate form. Also, Steve Brennan, a former constable for Precinct 1, is in the GOP race. Chavez, who is 59, served with the Odessa Police Department for more than 30 years and touts his background in law enforcement and his ability to conduct business in Spanish as critical qualifications to residents in the sprawling precinct. Woodall is an office manager at Brown Oilfield Services and, in her questionnaire, stated she is not fluent in Spanish but will make sure to have clerks who do speak Spanish available if elected. She did not respond to an email seeking to clarify what she meant by not fluent in Spanish. Texas Justices of the Peace are judges who have broad authority over matters that include setting bonds for criminal defendants, performing marriages, ruling on landlord-tenant disputes, presiding over criminal misdemeanor trials, and issuing and enforcing protective orders. Former J.P. Terry Lang is endorsing Chavez. Lang was Peace Justice in Precinct 1 for more than 24 years before retiring. He is asking those who voted for him in the past to support Chavez. He said Brennan didn't really perform his duties when he was a constable and said Woodall has been grasping at straws and is trying to use unfounded claims to boost herself. He said Chavez has picked up where he left off and is serving the public. He said claims that warrants are not being served have nothing to do with the work of a justice of the peace. Quote, "It's a dumb question, showing their ignorance. When warrants are issued by the JP court or any court, the warrant goes to law enforcement," he said. Lang also weighed in on the Precinct 1 commissioner's race and said he supports incumbent Mike Gardner. Challengers for the seat include David Shaw, Larry Glenn Robinson, and Linda Young Angley. Precinct 3 Commissioner. Incumbent Don Stringer faces the daughter-in-law of the man he defeated 4 years ago for the county commissioner's seat in Precinct 3. Samantha Russell hopes to unseat the incumbent and said she prayed and felt called to seek the seat her father-in-law, Jeff Russell, lost to Stringer 4 years ago. She has lived in Odessa almost 6 years and in Precinct 3 about 2 years. She is a bookkeeper at Paul Evans Carpet and said key issues include the courthouse, additional jailers, the library, and the juvenile detention center. Quote, "I'm not running because I'm a politician, but because I'm a concerned citizen, and I think it's really important that we have somebody on the commissioner's court for Precinct 3 that is going to listen to the voters and fight for the voters and that will get things done and not just make empty promises," she said. "I'm a doer. I'm a worker. And that's who I am." Stringer said he is a hard worker as well. Stringer says the commissioner's court's two most important achievements during his term were starting a planning department to regulate mobile home and RV parks and selling an Oklahoma City company a lease to drill 3 wells at Schlemmer Field. He said that decision will make the county-owned airport profitable for the first time in its history. Precinct 3 primarily lies within the city limits of the city of Odessa, including Schlemmer Field on the north side of town, off the east side of Andrews Highway. Stringer, the court's liaison to the airport board, said the county got a very healthy deposit 18 months ago from the Oklahoma City-based Continental Resources. Quote, "Our airport has come a long way," he said. "This project will make it self-sufficient, and it will make a profit for the first time," end quote. Stringer met with a surveyor and appraiser December 13th to identify the pad sites for the drilling rigs. Quote, "Continental is in the final stage of developing that field right now," he said. "The Federal Aviation Administration required us to have an appraisal done," end quote. Stringer is a 56-year-old native Odessan who graduated from Odessa High School in 1985 and worked as a well surveyor for ARC Pressure Data before qualifying as a realtor through Texas A&M University Commerce and joining Trower & Associates 16 years ago. He also attended Odessa College and the University of Texas Permian Basin. Russell is part of the Aztec High School class of 2001 in New Mexico, attended San Juan College from 2001-2002, Casper College in 2002, and studied criminology and psychology at American Intercontinental University online from 2011 to 2012. Russell put that pursuit on hold when she had her eldest daughter. Quote, "I actually ended up getting my real estate license, and I decided that I was going to go after that," she said, adding that she later went to work at Paul Evans. What you need to know. Early voting begins Tuesday and ends March 1st. Election day is March 5th. Visit the Ector County election page for a listing of times and places to vote at tinyurl.com/4EYVSDEX.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Health and Wellness for Wednesday, February 21st, 2024. Nominating Family Surprises Daisy Award Winner. Midland Memorial Hospital is proud to announce that Richard Yewon, RN, from the Orthopedic and Neuro Unit, has been awarded with the Daisy Award for Extraordinary Nurses. The Daisy Award is a special honor given to extraordinary nurses for their commitment to providing exceptional care. Yewon joins a worldwide community of extraordinary nurses who have impacted their patients in profound ways. The family that nominated Yewon attended the Surprise Award event to honor and recognize his dedication to compassionate patient care. The nomination by the family read, quote, "My brother was diagnosed with the same autoimmune disorder, ITP. The Barnes family is responsible for establishing the Daisy Award because of their deep appreciation for the nurses and the compassion shown to Mr. Barnes and his whole family. This is exactly why my brother and I believe that Richard Yewon is the perfect nurse to receive the Daisy Award. Our hospital stay has been filled with uncertain times, scary situations, and small and huge victories. Among the many nurses we had the privilege of working with, Richard embodies, with whom Richard has been the embodiment of the care and compassion that the Daisy Award was established to honor. We had the privilege of working with Richard at his side until the bleeding stopped, going the extra mile to make sure standing orders were put into place to ensure that the next time he started bleeding, the nurses could take the necessary steps to stop the bleeding without waiting for the doctor's orders, to answering any and every question each of us had. Every single time my brother called for him, he was in the room almost immediately. He sets the gold standard for exceptional and compassionate nursing," end quote. Yawan's commitment to compassionate care is evident in his patient interactions. He takes the time to get to know them and their families and is always willing to go the extra mile to ensure their comfort and safety. Yawan's dedication to his profession inspires his colleagues and patients alike. Quote, "Richard is a great nurse who is always willing to help his fellow team members. His gentle demeanor shows the care he provides to his patients," end quote, said Jimmy Coffran, manager nurse for the Orthopedic and Neuro Unit. According to Kit Bredemus, vice president and chief nursing officer at Midland Memorial Hospital, quote, "I think it is a testament to the impact that Richard made to have the family come to the hospital and present this Daisy Award. Richard not only made a difference to this patient, but to the entire family, who knew their loved one was in good hands," end quote. The Daisy Award is a special recognition of Yewon's commitment to providing exceptional care. Midland Memorial Hospital proudly honors Yewon with the Daisy Award for Extraordinary Nurses. For a complete list of Daisy Award winners at Midland Memorial Hospital, please visit www.midlandhealth.org/main/daisy-award-4-extraordinary-nurses.
This is the Dear Abby column. Father Ways Revealing Partner's Health Status. Dear Abby, I am a gay man who came out late in life. I have 3 grown married children and 5 grandchildren. They are my world, and we are all very close. I've had one partner. My family readily accepted and welcomed him because he made me happy. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. I have been seeing another person, and our connection is very strong. We have lots in common. I think I'm falling in love, and I envision a future with him. He is HIV positive. I am on PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, the most effective medication to prevent contracting HIV. We have not been intimate, but I'm aware of all the literature about the extremely low risk of transmission. My kids are bright, intelligent, and enlightened. I wonder if I should tell them about my boyfriend being positive. A part of me says that's his truth, and he should tell them if he feels compelled. I will not reveal it without his approval. Another part of me says it's not my children's business, because it applies only to intimate situations. But I've always been completely upfront with my kids about practically everything. So now I'm torn about what to do. Tell them, or he tells them, and risk getting a negative reaction, or I keep it a secret, no matter how uncomfortable that is for me. Please advise. Signed, How Honest in the East. Dear How Honest, if there were a compelling reason for your adult children to know your friend's HIV status, I would urge you to tell them. However, because none of them are likely to have sex with this person, I see no reason to share that information. Dear Abby, I have one sister I love. Our parents passed away 12 years ago, We don't have a good relationship, although I try. Recently, we have been texting again. Her son is being married in a few months. I have three children. My 26-year-old has been in trouble a lot and caused my sister's family hurt. He's not going to the wedding. My other boys are younger, 18 and 21, and they have never been in trouble. I have maintained somewhat of a relationship with my nephew. He has only three cousins on his mom's side. There are at least 17 cousins on his dad's side. Many of them have spouses, and they are all invited. My younger sons are not. Because I am deeply hurt, I have decided not to attend. My nephew's excuse for not inviting my sons was that attendance is tight. Am I wrong for not going? I can't help but think my sister and all but one of her kids don't want a relationship with my family. Should I let it go, or continue pursuing a relationship when it seems obvious the feeling is not reciprocated? Signed, Deeply Hurt in Texas. Dear Deeply Hurt, it's a shame that your two law-abiding sons are being tarred with the same brush as the one who is a black sheep. They do not deserve it. However, I caution you against overreacting by boycotting the wedding. If you attend, it will give you an opportunity to tighten family ties and to talk about how proud you are of your two younger sons, who are on the straight and narrow. You can contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.